Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Has the United States Constitution outlived its usefulness as the ultimate authority on American law and values? Our reverence for the Constitution runs so deep that the idea of converting it to a document that guides but does not dictate how we run the country strikes some Americans as the first step toward anarchy. But my guest today argues that disobedience of the Constitution began with some of the very men who signed it into law, and later was necessary for such achievements as the Louisiana Purchase, the abolition of slavery, and the establishment of New Deal safety net programs. Louis Michael Seidman is Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown University. His new book is called On Constitutional Disobedience. Mike, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's just a pleasure to talk with you.
You have devoted your career to studying the Constitution, teaching the Constitution. Talk about the genesis of the idea for you that our reverence for it might, in fact, be hindering progress and hurting public discourse.
Well, there are a lot of things. I mean, one thing is I've seen constitutional law being made, and it's a little like the joke about seeing sausage being made. It's not what most people think. It is more haphazard, more idiosyncratic, less principled than a lot of people think. But another thing that's happened, and I think this is really getting worse and worse, so people in this country have policy disagreements about things. But both sides, liberals and conservatives, instead of talking about the merits of their policy disagreements, it gets put into constitutional rhetoric, and that does two really unfortunate things. First, it raises the temperature of the debate, because now people are not just disagreeing about policy, they're disagreeing about what it means to be an American. And second, it diverts the debate into questions that are really irrelevant. So instead of talking about what we should do now, we end up talking about what the framers thought we should do in a very different country 225 years ago. And I think those are really unfortunate trends.
One of the, of course, a key example these days is the debate we're having about the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm. So most of my friends just won't believe it, but I'm actually very skeptical of gun control. But the reason I'm skeptical about it is that I just don't think it would work very well, and I think the cost of trying to make it work is just way too high for the benefits, given the amount of guns that there are in the country now. And it seems to me, you know, that's what we ought to be talking about. But instead, when the Second Amendment comes in, we end up talking about, well, what the word militia meant and what the relationship is between the prefatory clause and the operative clause and what the relationship is between our Bill of Rights and the English Bill of Rights and what the framers thought about muskets, which really have nothing to do with the weapons that people are using today. All of that's just deeply irrelevant. And so we don't end up talking enough about the topic that ought to concern us, which is what is sensible gun policy, not for a rural 18th century society, but a very heavily populated 21st century society.
So, Mike, one issue here for you is that people either look at the Constitution as a living document that ought to be adapted to changing times and circumstances, whereas others want a strictly originalist interpretation, and you see those two viewpoints as essentially irreconcilable.
Well, I not only say irreconcilable, I think they're both wrong. So people who are call themselves originalists want to bind us to judgments that were made many years ago, many of which are morally unacceptable, and in any case, it's very hard to translate them into modern society. So just to give you one example, I think most historians agree that the people who wrote the 14th Amendment did not mean to outlaw segregation. So the Congress that voted on the 14th Amendment had segregated the galleries of people watching by race, by their order. But I don't think many people today would say that we ought to say segregation is constitutional. So there's a problem with originalism. Now, that the people who believe in a living constitution don't have that problem. But the trouble is, if you read these broad phrases too flexibly, then what you're doing is you're saying the Constitution means whatever we want it to mean now, and you know different people want it to mean different things. And what's really quite offensive, I think, is when people read this broad language to mean what they want it to mean, and then insist everybody else has to obey. Because, after all, that's what the Constitution says, when it's really just their particular political program. And people both on the left and the right are guilty of this, by the way. It's not that one side has a monopoly on vice here.
So let's talk a little bit about history. You remind us that the Constitution itself was born out of a sort of disobedience to its predecessor.
Well, that's right. That's a real irony. The Constitution itself was, in some sense, unconstitutional. When the framers were called to Philadelphia, Congress directed them to amend the Articles of Confederation, which was the law at the time. And the Articles had a very specific method for amendment. They required approval by the state legislatures of all 13 states. Instead, as soon as the framers got to Philadelphia, they disobeyed their orders. They tore up the Articles of Confederation. And instead of providing for amendments in the way that the Articles specified, they said that the new Constitution would be adopted if approved only by 9 states, and not by the state legislatures, but by popularly elected conventions. And indeed, when the first Congress met and when Washington was elected president, there were still 2 states that weren't in the Union because they hadn't ratified the Constitution. So it's a little odd for people to insist that we ought to obey the Constitution when the people who wrote the Constitution themselves disobeyed the Constitution that was in force at the time they were working.
And then they ratified the Constitution and then very soon after had to significantly amend it with the Bill of Rights.
The Bill of Rights were part of the original bargain, in effect. Madison, perhaps the person most responsible for the Constitution, had promised that there would be a Bill of Rights. But very shortly thereafter, we began a practice that continues to the present day of disobeying the Constitution. So, for example, Thomas Jefferson was perfectly clear that he thought the purchase of the Louisiana Territory was unconstitutional, but he did it anyway because he thought it was good for the country. And I think, although this is more complicated, but maybe the greatest act performed by any American president, the Emancipation Proclamation issued by Abraham Lincoln, was a constitutional violation. Almost everybody, including Lincoln himself, agreed that it violated the Constitution for the federal government to interfere with slavery in places that it already existed. Lincoln, to his tremendous credit, and with, I think, quite flimsy constitutional justification, just overrode that, issued the Emancipation Proclamation, and that means that maybe the cornerstone event in our history occurred not because of obedience to the Constitution, but because we were ready to sacrifice something like 700,000 lives in a bloody struggle to change the Constitution.
How long did the framers expect the Constitution might last?
That's a good question. I think they had different views about that. So Jefferson thought that constitutions ought to be changed with every generation because he thought it was fundamentally illegitimate for one generation to control another. He analogized that to being ruled by a foreign country. Others of the framers thought it would last longer and were more resistant to change. But the important point is nobody in 1789 had any inkling of the kind of country we would become or the kind of issues we would face. It's hard to overemphasize how different the United States was in the 18th century from the nation that we've become.
And it's not simply the size of the population, but the way that this country earns its money and the scope of government, that sort of thing?
Well, yes. I mean, the United States at the close of the 18th century was a tiny, mostly agrarian country huddled along the eastern seaboard. It was largely dependent on slave labor. Ideas like participation in politics by women or by people of color or indeed by people without property were largely foreign. And, of course, the framers had no notion of things like nuclear weapons or terrorism. You know, it took weeks and weeks to cross the Atlantic. So the idea that a president might have to make a split-second decision about war or peace was not something they contemplated. They didn't know anything about the Internet. It was just really, really different. And it's just very bizarre, or at least it seems to me, to take decisions that they made which perhaps were wise in their time and just automatically and without thought or criticism apply them to our time.
What about people who would argue that, you know, new media that come along still can be defined according to things like free speech and the provisions that existed in the original documents?
First of all, let me just say, Chris, these are really excellent questions. So thank you for these are good objections to my thesis.
And thank you.
So they deserve to be addressed. So I don't mean to say that everything in the Constitution is bad. I don't think it is. Free speech today is important and something worth preserving. But here's the point. It's worth preserving because today it makes sense, and today it is an important value. It's not worth preserving just because a small group of people 225 years ago thought it made sense. In other words, we need to think about what does and doesn't make sense for us now and not just defer to people who may or may not have made wise decisions, but in any event, made them in a very different context. Now, it's not just that it makes sense to do that. In some sense, we have to do it because if you focus on the framers, so suppose you ask the question, for example, did the framers think that free speech included video games? Okay, mm-hmm. That's just a meaningless question. They didn't think one thing or another about video games because they'd never heard of them. So these are decisions we have to make for ourselves. Even if we wanted to defer, there's no way to defer to decisions that people then could not have made.
We're speaking this hour with Lewis Michael Seidman. He is Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown University and author of the new book on constitutional disobedience. We will resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You are invited to join us now by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lewis Michael Seidman, Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown and author of On Constitutional Disobedience. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Mike, I am really struck by the parallels between the conversation you and I are having about the Constitution and what is right within the law and what we value as Americans, and others that have come up on this show about the nature of morality and whether that is something that is divinely inspired or something that we sort of can be trusted to come up with on our own.
Well, that's an interesting analogy, Chris, but I think there's a problem with it, and that's this. You know, the Bible, people of religious faith believe that the Bible, or at least some people of religious faith, believe that the Bible is the Word of God, but the Constitution is not the Word of God. It was written by some very talented people who in some ways were very long-sighted, but they were human beings and human beings with flaws. And I think to treat the Constitution the way one would treat a religious text is actually a kind of idolatry. And I would have thought that people with religious sensibilities would be especially sympathetic to my argument because, you know, it is possible that there might be a gap between what the Constitution says and one's foundational moral commitments. And it seems to me somebody of religious faith would certainly say, I follow my conscience or my conscience informed by God, if one believes in God, and not something written by human beings.
What can we learn by looking at highly functioning democracies elsewhere that operate according to tradition and civic engagement but don't have constitutions?
Well, I think the honest answer is there's a limit to what we can learn because different countries have different cultures and different histories, and so it's treacherous to make easy comparisons. But having said that, it is true that there are well-functioning liberal democracies in the world who seem to do just fine without constitutions. So the primary examples are the United Kingdom and New Zealand. It's a little more complicated, but Israel might also be an example. And these are countries with records on civil liberties that are comparable to our own. They're countries that have not devolved into chaos. It's not a Hobbesian nightmare of a war of all against all. They seem to do just fine, and that at least suggests that it is not impossible for a country to function without a constitution.
We have an email here from Julian in Dallas who writes, over the last 11 years, the federal government has decided it has the right to listen to your conversations and read your emails without warrant, to detain you without charge or access to counsel for literally years, and now that an unnamed high authority has the right to order your execution without trial, Julian says, I hardly think blind adherence to the Constitution is a pressing issue.
Well, Julian, here's the thing. All of those things happened with the Constitution in place, right? So the fact that there were all those civil liberties that occurred with the Constitution in place is not exactly an argument for why the Constitution protects civil liberties. I think what, in the end, the protection of civil liberties is not going to come from a piece of paper that is safely behind glass in the National Archives. Julian's examples illustrate that. The protection is going to come only if people like me and Julian do the hard work of convincing people today that they need to cherish and value those liberties and make people pay a political price if they start trampling on them.
Well, pay a political price is an interesting segue here. Could we be confident without the authority of the Constitution in our ability to check and balance the powers of each branch of the federal government?
Well, so let's talk for a moment about what the Constitution permits the branches of the federal government to do to each other. Mm-hmm. So under the Constitution, Congress could, if it wanted to, reduce the size of the Supreme Court to two justices. There's nothing in the Constitution that prevents that. It could take away big chunks of the court's jurisdiction. It could refuse to appropriate money to allow the executive branch to function. The executive branch, if it wanted to, after the Supreme Court struck down parts of the health care law, it could have said, well, that's your opinion, but that's not our opinion, and it could have ordered those provisions to be enforced anyway. Now, all those things could happen with a constitution, but they don't happen. And so the question we have to ask is, well, why don't they happen? And I think the answer is that we have long traditions in this country. We have the various branches have means at their disposal to oppose other branches. We have people with vested interests in protecting divisions of power. And all those things that we have now, we would have if there were a regime of constitutional disobedience also. They're, in the end, what protects us, and not, again, just a piece of paper, which, after all, has no guns, no will. It's just a piece of paper.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. One thing that's important to remember is Lincoln used slave labor in New Jersey to produce armaments for the North through till the end of his life, and slaves were not freed there until the end after the war in the North had won. But the reason I'm calling is the principles of the Constitution are necessary for the longevity of the nation. We need to refer to those, and organizations that have explicit principles last longer. I feel very disappointed that your guest has such a position of authority in protecting the Constitution at Georgetown, and he seems to be set out to destroy it.
Mike Seidman, what do you say to that?
Well, thank you for your comments, Mike. First, on Lincoln. Lincoln is a complicated and contradictory figure. I believe he was a great man, but like the framers, he was not without flaws. And I think we shouldn't deify any of these people. And I think Mike's doing a useful service by pointing out that Lincoln, like all of our presidents, had flaws. Now, the principles of the Constitution are necessary for the preservation of the nation. Well, to the extent that that's true, we ought to respect those principles for just that reason. But we shouldn't respect them just because somebody else thought they ought to be respected 200 years ago. This is our country. We have the right to rule it. We have the right to decide which principles make sense for us and which don't. And there are principles in the Constitution that don't make a lot of sense today. So just to take one egregious example, the Constitution contains the principle that if the people of Texas vote for Mitt Romney for president, that doesn't mean its electoral votes are cast for Mitt Romney. The electors could, if they wanted to, cast their votes for Barack Obama or indeed for Lady Gaga. Now, that's not a principle that I think any Americans believe in today, and yet we're stuck with it because some people 250 years ago thought that it was an important principle.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Tina in Fort Worth. Hello, Tina.
Hello. I have truly enjoyed this conversation today, and I was curious because you say traditions, but I think they're based on like ground rules or the Constitution, some kind of framework. And you also mentioned how both parties have manipulated or used the Constitution throughout history to serve their purpose. And it just seems like why would we want to give them more power now as far as, you know, deciding the principles or the way that we should go as a country?
So, Tina, I don't think that what I'm talking about is giving anybody more power. And Indeed, I'm not claiming that the Supreme Court should go out of business or that it should stop invalidating statutes. I do think that as you mentioned, Tina, it is really unfortunate when people take ordinary policy disputes that reasonable people can disagree about and dress them up in constitutional language. So, for example, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Everybody's for equal protection. Some people think that means gay men and lesbians have the right to marry. Some people think it doesn't. What a coincidence that that is lined up, the people who read that language in the different ways is lined up exactly in terms of who favors gay marriage and who doesn't, just on the merits. But instead of talking about the merits of it, we pretend that this is governed by the Constitution. And again, that has really bad consequences. It means we're much less able to talk civilly to each other, which is, in the end, what we have to do if we're going to stay together as a country.
Does the way we use the Constitution now keep us from recognizing or calling Supreme Court justices on the fact that they are indeed influenced by their personal and political ideologies in making decisions to interpret the Constitution?
Well, we have this gigantic conspiracy of silence about the Supreme Court, like the emperor and the new clothes. I think on some level, most Americans understand that when the court decides issues like abortion or affirmative action or gay marriage or health care, these are not really decisions about the Constitution. What an amazing coincidence that all of the judges appointed by Republicans, presidents, read this document one way and all the Democrats read it the other way, and it just so happens that this lines up with their political views. The American people are not stupid. So on one level, they understand this, but on another level, it's all dressed up in this nonsense that what they are doing is not making the rest of us follow become the kind of country they want to become. No. What they're doing is enforcing a sacred text. Well, that's nonsense, and it ought to be called nonsense, and people ought to be able to evaluate what the Supreme Court does with a clear understanding of what it is actually doing.
What about, we have the power to amend the Constitution. Might we be better off if we just simplified the process to allow for more fluidity to sort of speak to contemporary needs and issues?
So that's a good question, Chris, but now we are really stuck in a vicious circle. Because in order to simplify the process of amendment, we would have to amend the Constitution. And it's almost impossible to amend the Constitution. So we have the hardest Constitution to amend in the world. It requires two-thirds of both houses of Congress and three-quarters of the state legislatures. Given the fact that states are not equal in size, that means one quarter of the smallest states in the country could block an amendment, which is a tiny percentage of the overall population. And as a practical matter, that makes it impossible. So we have not had an amendment to the Constitution since the 1970s. I'm putting aside now the 27th Amendment, which was actually part of the original Bill of Rights. It just cannot be done if there is anything like even a tiny minority that opposes doing it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next up, we have Chevis, calling from Addison. Hi, Chevis.
Hey, how are you, Chris? Thank
Great.
You for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for the professor. Every time something comes up in the American political life, there is a group opposed to it, and therefore they find it, quote, unconstitutional. But has there ever been, even in modern times or in the scope of American history, a president who was told by the Supreme Court, you cannot do X? And he said, I don't think so. I'll just go ahead and do Y. Has there ever been a president who openly defied the Supreme Court?
That's a good question, Chavez, and the answer is a little complicated. Andrew Jackson acted in violation of an order issued by Chief Justice, the Chief Justice Marshall. Lincoln refused to obey an order by Justice Taney that would have released a prisoner during the Second World War. Franklin Roosevelt made clear in both of these cases, the Supreme Court ended up ruling in his favor, but he made clear that he was going to execute Nazi saboteurs, even if the Supreme Court told him not to, and he made some preliminary plans for violating a Supreme Court decision, striking down gold clauses and contracts, if the court were to rule against him, but they ended up ruling in his favor. So those are some examples of at least quasi-defiance. But there certainly are other examples where presidents have complied, perhaps most famously Richard Nixon with the Watergate tapes, where he turned them over after the court ordered him to do so.
My guest is Lewis Michael Seidman. He is Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown University and author of the new book on constitutional disobedience. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lewis Michael Seidman, Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown and author of the new book on constitutional disobedience. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Mike, we've been talking a lot this hour about the big sweeping ideas and values contained within the Constitution. There are also some little procedural things that have been codified down through the years within the Constitution that may or may not still work properly, even things as simple as the minimum age for a president of the United States.
Well, that's right. You know, when people say they're willing to fight and die for the Constitution, I think what they have in mind are what might be called the big ticket items, things like, you know, the protection of liberty and property and equality. But the Constitution is also a legal document with lots and lots of very technical legal provisions that I don't think any sensible person would fight and die over. You know, so it's just not obvious that it ought to be enshrined for all time, that the president has to be 35 instead of 30, or that, you know, the term of office should be 4 years rather than 6 years. There were lots of technical provisions. And, you know, Chris, one interesting thing is sometimes when these get in our way, we just disobey them. So my favorite example is
terms, the term for senators, and the Constitution is very clear about this. Senators are supposed to serve for 6 years, except for the very first senators who were chosen by lot to serve 2, 4, or 6 years so that they have staggered elections. Well, nobody thought about what to do about new states. And so from 1791, when Vermont was admitted to the Union as the first state, right through Hawaii and Alaska, we have just ignored the Constitution, Article 1, and we've had one senator from each new state serve less than 6 years. And you know what? The sky hasn't fallen. God in his wrath has not rained lightning bolts down on us. Things. And last time I looked, there wasn't rioting in the streets. Things have gone on just fine because we ignored something that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. John's on the line now in Dallas. Hey, John.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
There is a movement afoot in the country called the 10th Amendment Center, whereby we're trying to revive states' rights to, quote, nullify, unquote, any federal law that the states deem to be unconstitutional. So could, in fact, that succeed at some point, say, with the federal income tax, which I'm not sure was ever properly ratified by all the states, or perhaps Obamacare or something along those lines. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, John, I think the question you asked is, could this happen? And, in the real world, I don't have any illusions of grandeur. I don't think constitutional disobedience is going to become widespread anytime soon. Certainly not because I wrote this book, and I also don't think that anytime soon there's going to be state nullification of the income tax. So I just have some more modest, at least short term ambitions, and that is that at least we ought to stop beating each other over the head and shoulders with claims that somebody's acting unconstitutionally, and maybe have a little more toleration for people on the other side of these arguments, and more of an understanding that the great sweeping provisions of the Constitution are broad enough to encompass a wide variety of different views, and to encourage debate about those views rather than trying to sort of shut people up by just claiming that what they believe they can't believe because it's unconstitutional.
Should the multiple times in the course of modern history that the Supreme Court has made decisions that upheld and defended, say, civil rights, based on what they read into the Constitution, should those be used as good defenses of the continuation of the Constitution as the supreme law of the land?
Well, I don't think so, because I think that most of the cases we admire that the Supreme Court has decided actually were not were based on the justices' own views and not necessarily on what the Constitution contained. Mm. So let me give you a specific example. I've mentioned segregation already, but we now have conference notes that indicate why the justices voted the way they did in Brown versus Board of Education, which held segregation unconstitutional. And in particular, we know something about Robert Jackson, who is one of the most revered justices in the court's history. When Chief Justice Roberts was asked in his confirmation hearings which justice he most admired, he said Robert Jackson. And Jackson voted with all 9 justices to strike down segregation. But here's what he said. He said, not publicly, but he said to his colleagues, you know, this has no basis in the Constitution. I'm not doing it because it's unconstitutional. I'm doing it because it's a moral and political necessity. And like Lincoln's actions in issuing the Emancipation Proclamation, I think that is a great moment in American history and one we ought to be proud of.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Augustine on the line next in Fort Worth. Hi, Augustine.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well, thank you.
Well, my comment is, I'm from a third world country, and even though we are becoming one here, I think that after teaching a citizenship class, I admire the fact that this document has prevailed and sustained, you know, the system for as long as it does. However, I don't see the need in the future to continue to have professional politicians. You know, we should have two terms and out in every branch of the government, except for the Supreme Court, I guess. But if we don't do that, and more than two parties, we're going to continue to have this corruption that goes on every single re-election, because those people need to gather money, power, and they have to grant favors. As long as we have a concept like lobbying, in my opinion, it's just bravery in third world countries. We are just kidding ourselves. We have a good document, has worked for all this time. We need more conversations like this, more often at different levels, to be able to make people understand that those professional politicians are really just keeping power. Same thing with leaders like Jackson or Sharp. They're just using the power they gather from a majority or from a party or from a group to use.
What do you think about that, Mike?
Well, so I admire Augustine's willingness to think about ways in which the system is not working and ways in which it might be improved. But I think that he ought to go a little further and think also about ways in which it might be improved in contravention of things that are in the Constitution. So, for example, the Supreme Court, with regard to lobbying, as I think Augustine knows, the Supreme Court has said that the use of money in politics is protected by the Free Speech Clause. Well, maybe they're right about that, but maybe we ought to say so much the worse for the Free Speech Clause. Or, to take another example, the state of Texas, with millions and millions of people in it, has the same representation in the Senate as the state of Wyoming, with three people in it, right? Almost every person in Wyoming has their own senator. I'm exaggerating, but not by that much.
Mm-hmm.
That's very hard to defend, but it's also impossible to change under a regime of constitutional obedience.
1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Arlington. We have Chris on the line. Hey, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wondered, when Nixon turned over those tapes, I have a friend that works in the National Archives, and there were tapes that were much more relevant that weren't turned over, and there was 10 minutes missing in the tapes that he did turn over that they accidentally recorded over. I just wondered, are there any other examples that your guest would like to cite that might be a little bit better answer to that question?
I think I probably remember this better than Chris does. I'm old enough to remember it well, and I think it was more than 10 minutes. It was like 17 and a half minutes or something. But Nixon did, in the end, turn over enough material to get him impeached. Maybe a better example, in 1952, the Supreme Court held that Harry Truman had violated the Constitution by seizing the steel mills in order to prevent a strike during the Korean War, and Truman complied with the court's order and gave the steel mills back to their owners.
Let's go briefly. I think we have time for one more call. Let's speak with Zach in Fort Worth. Hey, Zach.
Hey, Chris. Another caller had asked a very similar question to what I was asked, so I did have another one.
Okay.
Your guest has mentioned some kind of exemplary or positive examples of presidents ignoring or disobeying the Constitution. I wondered if you could talk about some less positive examples, such as Jackson's ignoring the Supreme Court's decision defending or stopping Georgia from taking Indian land.
Right. So, Zach, you've asked exactly the right question. And so what we want to think about is not whether a president violated the Constitution or not, but whether the president did the right thing or not. And sometimes violating the Constitution is the right thing, sometimes it's the wrong thing. And so what we want to focus on is not what James Madison thought 200 years ago, but what is right today. And that might coincide with what he thought 200 years ago, it might not. But that's the relevant question we need to focus like a laser on.
So I'm guessing that you don't actually sense that what you have argued for here is imminent, that we are ready to sort of turn over the Constitution and convert it into a guidance document as opposed to the law. So can you talk about what you hope to come of the ideas that you present here, and if everyone in the country were to read your book, what you think might actually happen?
I'd get a lot of royalties. But look, what's required here more than anything else is a cultural change. And one interesting thing about cultural change is it often seems absolutely impossible until the moment it occurs, and then it seems inevitable. So the dramatic change that's happening with regard to gay rights is an example of that. Now, the question is, well, how does that come about? And I think, at least in the beginning, it comes about on the granular level with each person sort of having individual conversations and talking about things and not accepting things for granted that used to be accepted for granted. So I have just a very simple proposal. The next time somebody says to you, Chris, but that's unconstitutional, your response ought to be, so what? And then you can have a conversation about so what. And maybe you can be persuaded there are good reasons to pay attention to that. Maybe you can't, but at least this is something we need to talk about and think about and not just accept it as a given and something that can't be changed.
When you present these ideas to your students, is it often the first time anyone has ever encouraged them to think about the Constitution in negative ways?
So, first of all, it is important to understand I don't indoctrinate my students. I raise questions. Mm-hmm. And whatever they say, I try to raise questions about it just to get them to think harder. So this is something I try to get them to think harder about. And I've been really encouraged. Some of them had come up with the best answers for constitutional obligation I've ever heard. A few of them might be persuaded by what I say, but most of them, mostly what happens is they think harder about it. And as the title of your program suggests, that's what we really ought to be after.
Lewis Michael Seidman's new book is called On Constitutional Disobedience. Mike, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. You've been just great.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.